today on Against the Grain. As the environmental crisis worsens, not everyone is drawing the same lessons. On the far right, xenophobic and racist ideas are increasingly dressed up as a means of protecting nature. And, as scholar Alexander Manrisky posits, contemporary American culture furnishes a wealth of material for the right, from the ubiquity of apocalyptic and misanthropic ideas to concerns with wellness and bodily purity. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. While we tend to associate the left with concern for the environment, there's been a long and disturbing history of environmentalism on the right. My guest argues that the far right draws on a deep well of sentiment in American culture about nature and purity to cast blame for environmental destruction not on corporations or capitalism, but on immigrants, people of color, and the poor. Alexander Manrisky is Associate Professor of English at the University of Connecticut, and he's the author of Everyday Ecofascism, Crisis and Consumption in American Literature. Alexander, what part of the far right calls itself ecofascist, and what beliefs do they espouse?
That's a really tricky question, because I think the right as a whole, writ large, isn't particularly unified. I think there are all these little movements and sub-movements. Sometimes people are communicating with each other, acting in concert. Other times people are sort of just in a little online echo chamber. And it would be a mistake to say that ecofascism is something like a coherent movement of any sort. It is a word that some who identify with the far right have also identified with. I'd say the most notable examples in the US, at least, are the El Paso, Texas, and Buffalo, New York shooters, who both use that word to varying degrees to describe themselves and their ideas in the manifestos they wrote before they respectively murdered a number of Mexicans and Mexican Americans in El Paso and Black American grocery shoppers in New York. Their arguments kind of boiled down to, in an era of widespread ecological changes and potential resource scarcity, white Americans need to conserve resources for themselves. Oftentimes these arguments are really strongly rooted in the pseudoscience of eugenics and proponents of that from the late 19th and early 20th centuries, such as Madison Grant and his eugenicist / immigration restrictionist book, The Passing of the Great Race. Essentially, these folks are arguing that only certain sorts of people, according to race and also according to things such as like sexual orientation, other kind of social markers like that, can and are worthy of surviving in something like a climate-changed world. And one other thing that I want to kind of point out about these arguments, though, is that when you really kind of peel back that kind of surface level of, I'm worried about conserving resources, I'm worried about resource depletion, I'm worried about the destruction of wilderness spaces, when you really peel it back, there's really not much of a properly environmentalist critique happening. These sorts of figures aren't suggesting, for example, that individuals, populations in the global north think carefully about and change their consumption habits. In fact, they're quite happy with their own consumption habits. Their solution isn't to change consumption habits, it's to quote unquote thin the herd so that they can continue consuming the way they do without fear of, you know, they're kind of like a bugbear of carrying capacity being met. Those are really extreme examples, those shooters. There are other individuals will kind of use that term haphazardly in online spaces, 4chan and 8chan, Stormfront, which is sort of like a fascist social media space. And then other times, organizations will actively sort of debate that the use of that term. So I guess at the end of the day, what I want to say about it is there are folks out there who identify with that label and who, carry out pretty nasty acts in its name. But the term itself is not really fixed. I mean, oftentimes the folks who even identify with the label are coming from different places. They think different things. And they're often arguing about what the word means and whether it's useful or not, in some ways to an even greater extent than scholars and writers of think pieces at the center and on the left are doing.
Well, given what you've just said, the muddiness of this term, even for the far right, would you say, though, that the preoccupations of people who either might identify with ecofascism or who espouse a kind of politics that embraces a sort of reactionary environmentalism, that those ideas tend to overlap with the idea of the great replacement anxieties that we've heard so much about in recent years from the far right, this idea that whites are in danger of becoming extinct and replaced by people of color?
Oh, absolutely. A great deal of overlap. And it's not necessarily like they're two sort of discourses or ideologies that have converged. They sort of grow up together, so to speak. And by grow up together, I mean specifically that kind of great replacement idea and also Western environmentalism writ large. A lot of the, I mentioned that figure, Madison Grant, a few moments ago. A lot of the biggest proponents of eugenics, immigration restriction, the notion that specifically quote unquote Nordic white Americans were a master race, who were, that tides of immigrants were conspiring to overthrow in the US. That's a pretty old idea at this point, really hailing back to and before the late 19th and early 20th centuries, but that's really kind of when this big kind of like organized immigration restriction movement came together in the US. And it was it was based on similar arguments that you see today. Again, Grant's book was called The Passing of the Great Race. And the idea was that that liberal governments and non-white peoples were conspiring to replace white Nordic Americans in the US. But what often falls through the cracks when people talk about the origins of that, great replacement idea back at that moment is that a lot of those folks, Madison Grant included, were also kind of the biggest proponents and bankrollers of preservation and conservation, those origins of US environmentalism and Western environmentalism more broadly, which has transformed in a great many ways over the past 150 years. Those movements were really closely tied to immigration restriction movements, in part because, think about the national parks, for example. One of the arguments for national parks was that our parks signified a special, especially authentic American character that might be under threat from other influences from other nations.
What are the commonplace assumptions that Americans, whether they're on the left or the right or the center, often make about the environment, which you argue can provide fodder for reaction? So, it's not that these assumptions are not necessarily ecofascist in themselves, but can provide a kind of normalizing set of assumptions that then the far right can play on. What sort of assumptions, commonplaces, do you mean?
Sure. I think the big one is this kind of idea of nature with a capital N. The thing about environment is that, like anything in the world, our understanding of it, our assumptions about it, depend so much on the way we talk about it, right? On the kind of cultural edifices we build around these ideas in any given context. And there have been a lot of different ways around the world, even in the US alone, of making sense of environment, of explaining it, of understanding it. Multiple frameworks, multiple heuristics, multiple paradigms for understanding it. And a kind of really big one that's still very has it's a very strong grip on the cultural imagination is this idea of a capital N nature, pure wilderness, something that's untouched, something that's originary, something that hasn't been spoiled, that's pristine. And of course, there are also some more kind of like critical and nuanced takes. Ecological science teaches us that there's no such thing as an unchanging environment. Environments are always changing, they're very complicated. There's no such thing as kind of like a pristine, untouched blank slate because all sorts of organisms are constantly dynamically remaking the world they live with each other in. There is this sort of assumption, though, in a lot of that kind of preservationist and conservationist work I mentioned before, but also still like circulating in pop culture and in the way people in an everyday way kind of talk about environment with a capital E is in this kind of sense of like nature with a capital N, that there is a kind of state of nature that is untouched. Well, the great irony of our national parks in the US is that they're premised on that idea of setting aside untouched, unspoiled wilderness, something pristine, a sort of repository for supposedly authentic American characteristics. Many of the national parks, however, were to establish them, it required a kind of further removal of indigenous peoples from lands they had lived on and with and stewarded for hundreds, if not thousands of years. And those landscapes, the kind of the greatest of the national parks, you think of like Yosemite, for example, right? Those landscapes are hardly pristine or pure, or untouched by human hands. They are all the products of centuries of very careful land management by indigenous peoples. So that idea of nature with a capital N, this idea of a pure, pristine, untouched state of nature, is always a story that people tell. It's not necessarily a reality. It's something that sort of glosses over the very complicated workings and dynamics of any given environment. But it's also the same sort of logic that animates much of the far right when it comes to views on race, for example, or sexuality, or gender roles, and even disability, too, a lot of the time.
Right, so with that sort of common sense idea that pervades American culture that you were just describing as, nature with a capital N or environment with a capital E, isn't much of it kind of premised on the notion that the, and this is, well outside of the right, that the original sin is actually human beings, that, humans coming in contact with nature, and of course that assumes that we're not part of nature. That we are and have been the force that has despoiled the environment. Would you say that a focus on humans as the culprit is important to this broad discourse, which then the right particularly draws from?
I mean, I think it really depends. That is a very kind of prominent idea, but in a lot of different circles, and it's expressed in lots of different ways, is I think kind of one of the biggest ways that kind of idea was being worked with and spread in the second half of the 20th century, especially was with this sort of intellectual movement. I kind of hesitate to call it a movement because it wasn't particularly unified, but a lot of people kind of were working under this banner called deep ecology. And one of the kind of cornerstones, I shouldn't even say cornerstone, it was more of a kind of rhetorical excess because not everybody working in this field, seriously thought this, but it was a way in which they were kind of making their arguments really exciting or appealing. It was the idea, and one of those excesses was kind of this idea that any human contact with the wilderness space automatically sort of spoils it. And this is one of the major criticisms that was directed by other environmentalists toward deep ecologists too. I think it was this environmental historian William Cronin. I think it was him who kind of said, if that's the logic we're following, then the best thing humans can do for environment is mass suicide, because by that logic, any human contact automatically equals destruction. But the thing is, it's like for a lot of these deep ecologists, they weren't necessarily talking about themselves when they were talking that way. There was a sort of tacit assumption that they were properly ecological enough to live with their environments. It was other people that were the problem, right? So even this kind of like grand broad strokes language of humans are have always been and always will be a sort of stain on or plague on the earth, which shows up, as I said, in all sorts of contexts. Oftentimes the person doing the talking isn't talking about themselves. And that's in that kind of logic, that kind of way of talking about the world and humans' relationships to it, that is by no means limited to the right. Most deep ecologists identified with the left, even if today in the 21st century, many figures on the alt-right or the far right online are kind of arguing, oh, we need to be reclaiming deep ecologists. They're really one of us, right? A Countercurrents Press, which is kind of the preeminent white nationalist publishing house in the US, has started trying to reissue books by deep ecologists who identified with the left, who identified with anti-fascism in the 60s and 70s. They're trying to kind of appropriate those as hallmarks of the right because, again, of this idea that there is such a thing as like a pure, untouched nature and that humans are the problem. But for these folks on the far right, it's again, they're not talking about themselves. They're talking about kind of, if we're talking about nature with a capital N, they're also talking about this boogeyman culture with a capital C, by which they mean to stand in for all sorts of progressive advancements, including feminist movements, LGBTQIA plus advancement, all sorts of stuff like that. For these figures, that's culture with a capital C, and that's the problem. We need to go back to nature with a capital N. And of course, they're the ones themselves who are kind of setting the terms they want nature to mean.
Alexander Manrisky is my guest. We're discussing his book, Everyday Ecofascism: Crisis and Consumption in American Literature. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So the concern with humans' relationship with nature sort of culminates in anxieties around overpopulation. And of course, that is something that has had a history in the environmental movement. And a long history on the, I guess we'd say, the right around the poor and consumption of resources. And then for the far right today, an anxiety that non-whites are overpopulating the planet or overpopulating the United States. Can you tell us about the history of those sorts of anxieties and where you see a crossover taking place, or at least a space opening up in which concerns about overpopulation in the environmental movement lends itself to a far-right discourse?
Sure. I mean, and that kind of overlap, for lack of a better word, that's often been identified as sort of the key place where environmentalism, which kind of over the past 70 or so years has really been identified with the left or the center left, right? That's been the kind of the most fruitful area of overlap between environmentalism writ large or mainstream environmentalism and actors on the right. And to the extent that actors on the right kind of explicitly talk about, like this is the way we do it. This is how we get people on board with not just our own ideas about environment, but with, far right ideas about all sorts of things, right? That this is kind of explicitly, strategically a place where folks are working. But the whole anxiety around overpopulation that obviously is much, much older than the 20th century. Most famously, Thomas Malthus worries about population growth centuries ago. And Malthus really served as the basis for a lot of the big arguments about kind of population doomsday that were popping up in the late 60s and early 70s. Kind of most famously, Paul Ehrlich's Population Bomb and Garrett Hardin's Tragedy of the Commons. Those two folks weren't necessarily working in a vacuum, though. They were writing in a moment where environmental concerns had sort of exploded into the mainstream, in the 1960s, especially after a series of really kind of high profile environmental disasters, like the Santa Barbara oil spill, for example. Rachel Carson publishes Silent Spring, which gets people really aware of pesticides. And also just sort of, it's a moment where a lot of folks are really primed to start thinking about not just damage to environment, but the impact on humans. They just spent a few decades worried about nuclear fallout, and that is kind of like that kind of apocalyptic imagery or narrative is really kind of right under the surface of, I mean, Rachel Carson's Silent Spring begins with a quote unquote fable for tomorrow, which if you didn't know any better, you read it, it sounds like you're reading just a run-of-the-mill projection of nuclear fallout. So there's all this sort of like apocalyptic storytelling going on in the 60s and 70s. And folks like Ehrlich and Hardin were kind of working in the same vein. And I think that's a really important thing to note here, right? Is that they're working with not so much data as they are with a particular storytelling pattern. A storytelling pattern that has a really kind of old history in the US too, and that has for a long, long time animated the far right. There's a really fabulous book on this by Betsy Hartman, The America Syndrome, where she really thinks really carefully about how from the landing of the Puritans in New England onward, the idea of apocalypse, the story of apocalypse has a central place in American culture. And what I'm sort of getting at is that we're talking about a moment in the 60s and 70s where this apocalyptic narrative is mobilizing again for a lot of different reasons. And one of those reasons is fear of nuclear war. But that fear of nuclear war and the stories and images it generated sort of provided a foundation for the way people started talking about environment in the 60s, this idea of apocalypse, this idea of ecological apocalypse. And at the same time, older right-wing narratives about the apocalypse of immigration were resurfacing, you know, in new ways. And Ehrlich and Hardin were no strangers, you know, they were writing about damage to environment, right? But they were no strangers to right-wing arguments about kind of the pollution of white blood. Hardin was already sort of knee-deep in eugenicist circles. Ehrlich sort of kind of accidentally stumbled into them through his friendship with this guy, John Tanton, who you might recognize as sort of the mastermind behind most of the major anti-immigration organizations of the past 50 years. And Tanton was kind of from the get-go really on the, you know, like on the kind of like eugenic side of the population control argument, like specifically thinking about protecting white bodies, protecting white bloodlines. Ehrlich really kind of came to all that from like fears about environment, but they did overlap quite a lot. So all these folks were kind of traveling in the same circles at that time. And it was at this moment where large swaths of the population were really receptive to concerns about environment and also apocalyptic storytelling. And so they became really, really popular. So from the 60s and 70s, you have this overlap because the folks who were writing these kind of apocalyptic narratives of a population explosion and then inevitable collapse were kind of straddling the line between environmental concern and eugenic concern. It's actually wild if you read Hardin's Tragedy of the Commons now. He's being quite explicit about thinking, you know, famously kind of advocating for kind of private rather than public control of land and resources. But he's really blunt about saying that, you know, only certain well-bred people should be allowed to privately own any to begin with. You know, like he, so like it's really not subtle in that work. And so there are threads in what they were writing to begin with that were weaving these two things together, right? And so in the works to begin with, the suggestion wasn't that population was the problem, it was that quickly reproducing people of color in the global South who couldn't control themselves were reproducing too fast. That was the driver of the growth. And that wasn't something that right-wing figures inserted later. That was there at the beginning because these writers, Ehrlich, Hardin, etc., they were straddling both worlds. And so when that kind of this broader public who is really primed for apocalyptic storytelling, for concerns about environment, starts taking this stuff up, that kind of straddling of these two worlds sort of tacitly gets picked up into the mainstream.
Well, which, as you mentioned, for the last 60 years, we have seen environmentalism as being associated with the left. But would you say, in thinking about how these right-wing arguments have been baked into certain forms of environmentalism from the get-go, that environmentalism can be as right-wing as left-wing, that there's nothing inherently left-wing about it?
Absolutely, I would say that. I mean, environmentalism is not, it is not a political philosophy in the same way liberalism is, or in the same way conservatism is, or in the same way socialism is, or anarchism is. Environmentalism is a wide-ranging, incredibly diverse movement and a loose set of ideas. And that loose set of ideas needs some sort of politics to anchor it, and lots of different politics have. There have been socialist environmentalisms, like Murray Bookchin's Social Ecology. There have been very mainstream centrist environmentalisms, like green capitalism. The idea that through lifestyle changes, we might, you know, fix things rather than through large-scale structural change. Environmentalism is sort of, on its own, incoherent without this kind of loose set of priorities mapping onto other ideologies. And it's also, I think, that kind of hindsight that we, our knee-jerk is to identify environmentalism with the left. It's historically inaccurate and has more to do with the way in which popular culture is sort of has sort of shoehorned the 60s and the early 70s in general. Because the thing about the broad counterculture in that time, for example, think about that is it is exactly what the word says. It's a counterculture, which is to say it's not limited to the left or the right. It is just, at least on the surface, anti-establishment. And there were many folks who participated in the counterculture who associated with the left. There were many who associated with the right. People tend to associate that period with Students for a Democratic Society, famously left-wing youth organization. But there was also its counterpart, Young Americans for Freedom, famously conservative, libertarian in the more conservative than leftist way. And a lot of the folks who were involved in that later went on to be, like, for example, high up in the Reagan administration in the 1980s, right? So it was exactly what the word says. It was countercultural. And pop culture, though, in the years since, tends to represent the 60s and early 70s and the counterculture in general as a leftist movement, when it's not, right? It's more about the kind of anti-establishment attitude, which, like environmentalism too, will cleave to whatever kind of particular ideology a given practitioner is working from.
Alexander Manrisky is my guest. We're discussing everyday ecofascism, crisis and consumption in American literature. This is Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Alexander, you were just talking about the period in which modern environmentalism emerged in the 1960s and the 1970s. And I wanted to ask you about some of the movements that came out of that period and how they understood these questions of nature and society and the inequalities and hierarchies within society or not. And I wanted to ask you about the movements, which of course were many in the 1970s, coming out of the 60s, the Back to the Land movement, people trying to live cooperatively. How do you think of those efforts in shaping assumptions that really remain to this day about the environment, which can be not just appropriated by the right, but are sometimes imbued with a logic which we would identify not with forces of social redistribution, but of inequality and racism and nationalism?
The one example that I use in the book that I really kind of pay a lot of attention to is that of the Whole Earth Catalog, which ran through several iterations. It was the brainchild of this guy, Stuart Brand. And, you know, I was just talking about how The word counterculture is exactly what it sounds like. It's not limited to left or right. It is countercultural, and that meant it was inclusive of people spanning, a variety of political spectra. The one thing they all had in common is that they weren't interested in the center, and Stuart Brand is a great example of what we today might identify as contradictions. They're not contradictions, just have to remember it was a different political moment, and that our ideas about partisanship change over time. And Brand was a self-identified libertarian. He was this guy who created this Whole Earth Catalog, which is this major, I should add, it was just this major resource for a lot of folks involved in the Back to the Land movement. And the catalog is it's a really kind of cool document. It went through several issues. I have a few copies of some of them. They're just really interesting and weird kind of documents. People like booksellers joke that they have no idea where to put them in their stores because you open it up, it's on kind of like what almost looks like newsprint. They're thick, they're long, and they have all sorts of stuff in them. They have like serial short stories scattered throughout the whole thing. One of the issues even had a full novel that was like in installments throughout the whole thing, but it was also like actually advertising and selling like tools, like interesting items, new technologies that especially folks interested in returning to the land, according to the Back to the Land movement, were interested in. And so it was this really interesting moment where you have a lot of people who on the face are really kind of like opposed to like the idea of the marketplace, capitalism in general, right? And yet one of the most fundamental, foundational sort of texts or artifacts of that moment was essentially a mail order catalog that was all about new commodities, what to buy, what you need, right? Like what we recognize as sort of like mass marketing today, telling people what they need so that people want to buy it. Even if those things were genuinely intended to help people live more sustainably on the land. And they very much were. That was a very genuine commitment on the part of Brand. But it was really wedded to this very market-based solution. Even though, right, because we associate that idea of kind of market-based solutions with what is on its face hyper-individualism, but even though that these particular tools are being marketed to communities of people who are often trying to live communally. But what I find really interesting about the catalog and about Brand, about the way Brand would talk about these things, is that there's a lot, it just really resonates with many of the kind of like earliest ideas about land ownership and stewardship in the US, in Jeffersonian democracy, right? One of the greatest justifications in the 16th through 19th centuries for seizing land and dispossessing indigenous peoples was that they didn't use the land effectively. They didn't use it appropriately. They owned land in common, and that was not correct. That was not what the land was supposed to be. And it did not establish citizenship. Proper citizenship was about working the land. You work the land, you develop, you change it, you change it, you develop ownership over it. And so there's this kind of really close relationship between human individual and environment, even in the kind of early US liberal tradition. And that's really what Brand is also working off of, this kind of Jeffersonian idea that you develop an appropriate relationship with the land based on how you work with it. And for, the Whole Earth Catalog, the right way to work with land is to buy the right tools. And so even though there's this whole kind of vogue for living communally on the land, to living sustainably, that again, as I said, is very, very genuine, right? It was also intermingled in really interesting, and I think what today would feel or seem almost foreign, this intermingling with these kind of market-based, hyper-individualistic solutions that are all about what products are you buying? How are they helping you cultivate a different sense of ownership over the land you're on? And what all of this starts to sort of do is, or not starts to do, but kind of continues doing, is reinforce this idea that only certain people belong on the land. Only certain people should be allowed on the land. Only certain people are worthy of living with the land. And in this case, it's certain people who buy certain things.
So one of the concerns that came out of the movements of the 60s and 70s, including around back to the land, was around food. The consumption of food, the purity of food, which of course has a pretty long history in the United States. And of course, that is something that then had a resurgence since the 1990s, I guess, a focus on food as a way of living more harmoniously with nature, of appreciating and being connected to regional ecosystems. Can you talk about this concern around food and sort of the regional food movements that have grown up around that concern and where that kind of notion of humans' relationship to nature can very easily go rightward?
Sure. Yeah. So this is another thing, right? I think this is becoming a sort of theme in this conversation a lot more explicitly. It's a theme in the book too that I think it's a lot more implicit than, and I'm glad we're talking about it like this. This is another thing. Food and food politics require a scaffolding. The way we think about food depends so much on how we talk about it and how we frame it in relation to other political ideas. And I'm thinking about just today, for an example, right? On the one hand, you have movements on the left that are really concerned with food security, with the access of particular populations living without easy access to healthy food, having much higher incidences of particular diseases or deficiencies in terms of health. And there's this really kind really broad-based food justice efforts to ensuring that underserved areas have access to healthy food and aren't just kind of being nickel and dimed by mass marketed cheap unhealthy stuff. That is also kind of like a concern on the right. Of course, we have the whole MAHA movement right now too, right? Which is putatively about the same or very similar things. But I would also point to kind of like looking online in sort of the same like forums I mentioned earlier, where especially young men identified with the far right kind of hang out. And again, it's really important to pay attention to not just the commitment to healthy food, but to the way it's talked about, the way people frame it. And oftentimes you have this sort of manosphere culture in which healthy food is really central, or if not kind of like healthy food in the sense of like, fresh, locally grown produce, then things like raw meat, right? Where the goal for a lot of these speakers is bodily purity, right? Again, it goes back to that idea of nature with a capital N. It's, I don't want to pollute my body with things that are artificial. And artificial can mean all sorts of things, depending on who's doing the talking, right? And the idea is that I need to eat natural foods, again, like the raw meat, in addition to locally sourced produce. That way, I have cleansed my body of impurities and I am ensuring that I am vital and I am strong and I am, superior. That's what it's really all about. It's this idea of nature with a capital N as a mark of superiority. Whereas the emphasis in left-leaning and leftist food justice movements tends to be far more about community health, community viability, less about the so-called purity of the individual body. And that tends to be what kind of right-leaning interest in food is about. But it's also, again, it's one of those gray areas. I look at examples in the book of folks who identify with segments of the left and yet tend to repeat many of the same arguments that you see among those sorts of young men online about bodily purity, right? And again, it's because concern about food is not itself a political ideology, right?
Alexander Minrisky, can you tell us about the wellness industry, out of which quite a few of those concerns around bodily purity are tied? How did it emerge and where you sort of locate its politics? Because obviously, one of the things that gave the right such a boost was the COVID pandemic, and people who were tied to the wellness industry, many of them saw that taking a vaccine was a way of damaging the purity of one's body with some, you know, synthetic intrusion.
Sure. And, you know, that's, you said it correctly, right? The bodily purity thing is just as much an important factor here as it is when thinking about food politics. A lot of the time, anti-vaxxers are not necessarily opposed. They're not necessarily opposed to inoculation. They're opposed to vaccines. They're into inoculation. They're into the idea of being exposed to a disease to develop a bodily strength against it. But of course, for them, it's a natural bodily strength versus an artificial or a synthetic one that a vaccine would deliver. The wellness industry in general, again, it's one of those tricky things. Lately, people jokingly refer to it the wellness to fascism pipeline. And again, that bodily purity point is really central to that idea of the pipeline, right? And this is connected to the Whole Earth Catalog thing too, right? It's no accident when we talk about the wellness industry, we're talking about products, right? We're talking about who is and has the money to purchase these particular products that render them bodily pure and use that as an excuse to ignore broader systemic structural challenges that might result in other people, for example, not having the money to buy those products, not having the means to achieve this high bar of bodily purity that these speakers are setting for themselves. So when you have in the COVID-19 pandemic, people on the right complaining, you know, why should I wear a mask? Why should I protect these people who aren't protecting themselves? And they're talking about service workers who are overwhelmingly people of color. They're talking about older individuals whose bodies are not as equipped to handle infection as younger ones. They're using this particular act of consumption that they have engaged in as a way to paper over much more challenging questions about social inequalities, structural differences. The wellness industry itself is, again, one of those things that historically is not really a matter of the left or the right. In fact, one could argue that it really grows out of the kind of like New Age movement, which critics at the time in the 70s and 80s just sort of referred to the New Age movement as kind of the counterculture being co-opted by capitalism, right? The political counterculture fades a little bit, the political edge is lost, and the New Age is what you get when people start trying to make money off of the kind of attitude. So again, there's sort of this assumption that like the wellness industry, the New Age, they're identified with the left, right? Because they're kind of growing out of this movement. But again, all that stuff is not about, you know, particular political ideologies. It's about attitudes and concerns and problems that might map in different ways over political ideologies. We can think about the wellness industry in really similar terms. The last thing I'll say about it, though, is that, you know, one of the big critiques on the anti-vaccination movement, also just wellness enthusiasts of vaccines or pharmaceuticals, is that they're owned and controlled by large corporations. That's a really valid and important critique. And there are many on the left who make it as well, right? But what I always find really interesting is that for whatever reason, a lot of these same people are not thinking the same way about the wellness industry, which is sort of the same thing. They're consuming these alternatives, which are themselves owned and controlled by large corporations. And for me, it's just a matter of how these different industries have packaged what they're selling. And again, it boils down to this really facile distinction between nature with a capital N and artificial or cultural or what have you on the other side of that binary.
You know, you've been arguing that there are these sort of everyday assumptions that people who would not identify with the right, who might even be, you know, absolutely appalled by the right, people on the left, people in the center, tend to make about our relationship with the rest of non-human nature. And the various sort of assumptions and statements people can make that in many ways give kind of the material that the right can then utilize in shifting politics much further to the right. And, you know, some you mentioned in the book how at the beginning of the COVID pandemic, along with people observing how there was so much less pollution because cars were not on the roads during lockdowns, that also, you know, if people died, would that be a good thing for the environment? The idea that people have children are breeders and they are damaging the environment that way. These statements, which, as you have said during the hour, really miss the fundamental dynamics of who has power in the society. And often those arguments end up seeing the people who, you know, should suffer, whether it's stated or not, as not wealthy people in the global north or not affluent people in the United States. It's not just that you're saying certain ideas get appropriated by the right, but actually may have a lineage that comes from the right or is imbued with these ideas of the worthy and the not. What do you argue should be done at this point to try and shift the discourse on the left, given the fact that the far right is much more powerful than it has been in decades?
I think maybe this is just a good moment to think about the word fascism in general. It's an infamously challenging word to define. One of the reasons it's challenging is because earlier I mentioned, you know, like, oh, liberalism, conservatism, socialism, anarchism, these are all political ideologies that have a body of work. You know, they're theoretically articulated. They have a lineage. They are theories. Fascism, not so much. Classical fascist movements and regimes did not really have like a coherent ideology. And I think that's why when I was thinking about the idea of ecofascism, a lot of people are thinking about that word and they're just sort of using it. I'm like, well, I want to know, like, how should we be using it? What should that word mean? And to start, I want to know, understand better what fascism means, even though it's such a hard word to describe. Because, like, it's a very particular word. It doesn't just mean authoritarianism. It doesn't just mean populism. It doesn't just mean nationalism. Because populism and nationalism are things that themselves happen in a variety of ways, on the right, on the left, etc. In imperial contexts, in decolonial contexts, etc. So the things I really learned from really doing a deep dive into the field of comparative fascist studies is that when we talk about fascism, what we're talking about is a normative concept. So it should mean something specific. It should mean something that's different than far-right populism on its own. Another thing that I really found interesting about it was that historically, fascism succeeded in Italy and Germany because people from the left, right, and center got on board. It did not discriminate in terms of existing ideological affiliations, which kind of makes the concept even more confusing. But I think at the end of the day, what I found most revealing and kind of like studying this literature was that fascism is really all about its conditions. And there are really kind of two important parts about its conditions. The first is that fascist movements and regimes tend to emerge, arise, or gain momentum in periods of rapid class stratification. That's thing number one. Thing number two is that, again, fascisms do not historically have like a intellectual theory. Rather, movements and regimes work with existing nonpartisan cultural narratives, symbols, themes that already exist, that are really deep-seated in a given culture. And they sort of work with them, remix them a little bit to get people from left, right, and center on board. So to answer your ultimate question, what I want to say about how can we rethink things, how can we kind of like counter this, is the first step is an understanding that is we're not talking about a far right that is just working with a crazy far right ideology and somehow convincing people to get on board. What we're talking about is we're talking about ideas that have a really, really deep, deep history in the US that are being mobilized in new ways. Ideas like I was just talking about, Jeffersonian land ownership, really deep-seated thing in US culture, but it's one of the kind of primary cornerstones of the sort of explicit eco-fascist violence you see in El Paso or Buffalo. Understanding that the ideas that are in play here are existing and popular ideas is the first step. The second thing is recognizing again that fascism is all about its conditions, that it's because of rapid class stratification. It's because enough people across the political spectrum feel dislocated enough to buy into a sort of essential mystical idea of national character that sort of papers over and obscures the real cause of that rapid stratification, which is, of course, kind of policy changes and the accumulation of wealth and power in a very small number of people's hands. One thing that people can think about doing is, right, these are really popular, deep-seated cultural narratives. How might those same narratives be brought to bear in different ways when remixed kind of differently in ways that don't lead to outcomes that on their face really resemble far-right violence? You know, how might those same narratives, because for better or for worse, whether we kind of like them or don't like them, they are here, they are popular, they are broad, we should indeed critique them, but how can we also understand them pragmatically and use them? The same sorts of really deep-seated ideas and myths and symbols in our culture in ways that turn to different ends.
Alexander Manrisky, thank you so much for coming on the program.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Alexander Manrisky is Associate Professor of English at the University of Connecticut, author of Everyday Ecofascism, Crisis and Consumption in American Literature. He's also the author of Wild Abandon, American Literature and the Identity Politics of Ecology. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.